Thank you. This is the 13th lecture of the 3rd Joburg ACC, Monday, 13th February, AD 11. Very coincidental, the 13th lecture on the 13th. This ought to be a lucky one. Okay. Now, we're progressing very nicely with the pre-havingness scale. I should comment that there are three additional points on this scale. The oldest one is waste. And waste comes just ahead of abandon. Waste and failed waste. And apparently lesson belongs someplace on this scale in hope. They've been turned in by a couple of people. And very thoughtful of them. I haven't got them spotted on the scale. But waste definitely belongs just before abandon. The lecture today concerns change. Change as a processing factor. In view of the fact that you were seeking to obtain a change in your PC, and in view of the fact that change does not work very well in old SCS, you know, the one point where you don't get anything happening is change in SCS. You know, you run out the starts and you run out the stops. And all you do with change is unsettle the starts and stops. You're aware of that, I'm sure. Change, as far as SCS is concerned, is not particularly therapeutic. However, change, in general, has been long recognized as a therapeutic activity. You'll find that there are several therapies, and the oldest one of these therapies is change, which is merely shift the environment, fella. You can accomplish things with the human mind with change of environment. You know, the medicos picked it up from the old boys, and they've long been recommending that somebody take a rest, by which they mean a change, by which they hope you'll collapse. Go down to the seashore, you know, and get re-stimmed by the waves on your clam track. Change. And the other one is education. And these are the two oldest therapies. There are no other rivals for those. So you have, actually, in extant today, you have change, education, and processing as the only three available therapies on Earth. The first two, of course, are just hideously old. They are way back. I can see it now. The first witch doctor set himself up in business because he was tired of hunting. I can see him now. He says, well, you bring me a haunch of venison as your fee, you know. Well, now, what you need, Ugg, is a change. That's right, you should change. You need a change, Ugg. And the second one, education, has been carried on from those ancient times until now, which is, what's wrong with you is, you know, evaluation. That is merely a brand of education. Obviously, if, as they managed finally to do in the Middle Ages, the Roman, you see, up right until now, has been the big bugbear. He was the nasty man. He was the cowboy in the black hat, according to everybody. And the Roman had very, very little in the way of healing. He had surgery of a sort, and he had bone setting, And in childbirth, he had twilight sleep, which was invented with great credit a few decades ago. But he actually did use this. And a few other things. But basically, what he used was education. He educated people to be healthy. He educated them into being clean. He educated them into this. You know, you get the idea. He taught them to exercise. He taught them to do this. He taught them to do that, you know. And after he got through with all this education, why, people had a civilization. It was almost another 1,700 years before people bathed again. It took an Arab in the court of Frederick of Prussia to teach Europe to bathe. And, of course, a lot of their ills disappeared the moment they started bathing again. You would be utterly amazed how not washing can speed up the deterioration. But, frankly, I don't think people can be taught to bathe until their pride and so forth is back up to point. You look at a horse or a dog that is in foul mental condition, and he's dirty. Always. And you look at a horse or a dog that's all cheered up and so on, and they're all cleaned up, too. They go clean themselves up and so on. This is cleanliness is a morale factor. It has to do with mental condition more than anything else. But education is on the score of, let's say, mental hygiene or something of this sort. You know, there might be nothing to mental hygiene at all. But if we teach everybody it will be all right, providing we practice hygiene of some kind or another, you see, then they've got the postulate, and they're continuously making the postulate, well, I'm all right because I am doing so-and-so. You get the idea? Well, education is the held fort, which, of course, opposes to change as the altering fort. Education is the installation of stable data, which are supposed to be unchanging. Do you see that? And change, you see, is itself merely a method of getting away from re-stimulators. Now, change as a process is quite interesting. You'll find change being used on the HAS co-audit again. This process originally was developed very early in 1955. A girl came in who was quite raving as a psychotic. And I asked her who was wrong in her family. She said her mother, very bitter about her mother. So I ran her for some 2.5 hours in two sessions. 2.5 hours overall. What could she change about her mother, and what didn't she think she could change about her mother, you see? That was all. Just found a terminal, asked her what she could change about it and what she didn't think she could change about it. Plus and minus change. And she went sane, and that was the end of that 5,000-hour intensive. My intensives usually last about 2.5, 3 hours. That's why I get impatient with you characters. Now, change as such is a tremendously important factor. It is the shift between two stabilities, or the alteration between two fixations. Now, psychology, as you know, was originally a religious subject. That's right. It was developed and used by the Roman Catholic Church. It's known as faculty psychology and has the genesis of about the 16th century. It's taught in all of their universities and so forth. Modern psychology is simply a successor to this religious activity. It has dropped the psyche as a study. because of religious prejudice on the subject itself, the psyche was never studied by the Roman Catholic Church. All they studied was perception. Hence, we have this subject called faculty psychology, which was the study of the perceptions of man, and that is about the 16th century. Probably the last time there was any kind of a breakthrough or much intelligence used in the field of mental examination right up till right now with the subject we're dealing with. The faculty psychology deteriorated and disappeared, and then, it became philosophic and had less and less to do with the havingness and reality of things, and eventually this fellow Wundt jumped up in 1879, revived the whole subject. It had practically disappeared up to that time, and he came up with a tremendous discovery that man was an animal and that the brain did everything and there was no psyche. So this is pretty good. And he's carried on until modern times, that work. That's what's taught now in the universities and so forth. It's rather mixed up with dialectic materialism, oddly enough. Naturally, any highly materialistic subject such as the brain is all and so forth would degenerate into something that said all ideas are the product of two opposing forces. And highly materialistic. So what we're doing is coming up in a highly materialistic field and reestablishing some of these studies. They didn't know very much about this. As a matter of fact, they listed the senses, and you will find today they're still listing the senses as they listed them in faculty psychology. They say there are about five senses. Your sixth sense is some intuitive sense. That's why. And there are five senses, and then there's a sixth sense, which is intuition. The last time I gave any attention to this at all was about 1951, and found that there was a minimum of about 53 perceptions. That's minimum. Faculty psychology listed five. I don't know how they missed the remaining 48. Some of the old-time Dianeticists, we were sort of having a contest on how many we could find, you know. And we kept turning them up. Eventually there were 53 of them, and by that time we quit. All quite valid. But of course, people who can't see very well or feel very well or think very well are not liable to be able to count the perceptions very well. That's approximately what happened. Well, now here are this tremendous number of perceptions. Now, why these perceptions? Why? What does a perception perceive? It perceives a stability or a change. That's all it perceives. That's a shocker when you come to look at it. There's this tremendous equipment recognized in the 16th century as having five of these, in actuality about 53. I'll have to dig up that old list someplace or another. It just goes on and on. But 53 perceptions, all of them dedicated to recognizing just one of two things, a stability or a change. And a change is simply regarded as the shift between two stabilities. So that's all these perceptions perceive. And the whole subject of attention, which was probably, it didn't receive the credit it deserved, the whole subject of attention. You see, perceptions are simply subdivisions or types of attention. Attention covers the whole lot, you see. And what attention perceives is the stability of something, or that the stability has shifted, or is another stability, or has gone, or, you see, in other words, it's perceived a change in a stability. This is all very high-flown and esoteric, and has a great deal to do with what you're doing when processing, because your PC is sitting there, fixed with 53-plus perceptions on a near, it's an unimaginably, it isn't infinity, but it's an unimaginably large number of stabilities and shifts between them. Now, his attention has been so fixed for a very long time because his experience in time is no more and no less than sequential observation. As far as time is concerned, time, of course, is itself, and you can make up your mind to the fact that it exists. It just is. Time isn't just change. Time is itself. Just time is. Change marks time. You never see the time, but you see the hour hand of the clock shifting. The shift of the hour hand of the clock measures then the fact that time has progressed. But the hour hand of the clock did not progress the time. You see, the time would progress even if the clock had run down. So what this amounts to is the fact that time is, just like the other elements of the sixth dynamic, time is, just like mass is, energy is. But change is very close to time. Very, very close to time. It is what we measure time by. Now, in the old Dianetic axioms, we found time was the single source of aberration. It is, too. I wouldn't even bother to go on and explain why it is. It's too observable. You find nearly everybody is complaining about something, and it'll all have to do with time. Time will be an element in every complaint anybody ever has. Even if they're complaining about nothing ever happens, they're still complaining about time. They're saying, look at all this time with nothing in it. Now, any direct process on the subject of time will produce an interesting change of case. Now, probably the least bombastic is recall a time. Thank you. Recall a time. Thank you. Recall a time. Now, if you'll notice, that is the common denominator of all of those old processes. Recall a time when you had an accident. Thank you. Got the idea? Recall a time you were hungry. Recall a time your head ached. Recall a time your mother beat you. Anything that you care to say on this, it still has this common denominator, recall a time. And oddly enough, recall a time can be used as a process all by itself. It's interesting things happen. Recall a time. Thank you. Recall a time. Now, that's probably the least beefy one. Now, let's take a more modern one. There's a more modern process that is in your commands. It's part of a two-part command. But it just says, when would you rather not be? Now, you probably haven't run that on anybody yet. Hasn't been out long enough. But it's an awful bank booster. You just said, when would you rather not be? Thank you. When would you rather not be? Thank you. You've, all of a sudden, the bank goes, creak. He's changing position on the time track because he's resisting stabilities. And resisting stabilities, he, of course, flips himself into change. Now, the basis of aberration then comes under the heading of a fixed stability that is unalterable and unsuitable. and a period of flux where there is no stability. Between these two things, you get aberration. You also get life. But the individual, well, you see, life is just putting your attention on something and not having your attention on anything. And attention is subdivisible, as I said, into 53 perceptions plus. Now, the individual who thinks all horses sleep in beds, and that's the fixed datum about horses, is, of course, daffy on the subject. But is he daffy, or is the datum daffy? Well, factually, we could go on with that argument for a very long time and say, well, the data is crazy and the PC is sane. And we could have a lot of argument about this. As a matter of fact, you can see this. This is quite a valid observation, that an individual living in a psychotic environment will appear psychotic. You know, the environment can be crazy. It's not always you. The environment can be mad as a hatter. And none of your fixed data, none of your stabilities match up to the environment at all. Well, of course, the environment says that your fixed abilities are no good. And at some time or another, all of your fixed abilities were more or less sane. But the environment shifted. You've got for instance, in modern times, with the decadence of family, its deterioration, with the state assuming, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, more and more responsibility for the individual and actually seeking to destroy the family as a unit, economically and otherwise, you get a condition where anybody who had a bunch of fixed, stable data about what he was supposed to do, the now I'm supposed to, you see, to be a good husband or a good wife or a good son or a good daughter, would appear quite mad in a communist environment. Quite mad. Now I'm supposed to take care of the old people in their old age? Why? Every communist doctrine they have is in violation of this. You see? Socialistic doctrines are all in violation of it. It says the state should take care of the people in their old age. The communist environment says the people in their old age should be shot or something, or just skipped. Because they're not producers. Every time I say something about communism, I get a weird wish-wash in this audience. So you guys sure don't know much about communism. I'm not just beating the drum on this subject of communism, you know. It is. It has certain tenets, it has certain ideals, it has certain behaviors. In an overpopulated time, of course, communism is an optimistically wonderful philosophy. It lets you shoot all the non-producers, live up to no social responsibilities, and the taxation is fantastic. Taxation in a communist country is about 70%. It's 50% immediately. You produce something, the state's the only purchaser. It produces things at 50% of what it sells them for. So if you were making underwear, the state would buy it from you for 50% of what it was going to sell it for and sell it back to you for twice as much, you see? The consumer, then, pays twice as much as he receives. This is always bound to make poverty one way or the other. Now, in view of the fact that this money never goes out to distributors or anybody of this nature, this money never sticks around in the society, but gets stuck in the state for their projects, such as shooting Sputniks up in the air and so forth, and other vital activities, you get a terribly interesting economic picture. And it's a better answer to overpopulation than socialism, because socialism, the more overpopulation you get and the more people that can't work, the harder you have to support them. And communism, that's not true. When you get people who can't work, why, you dispense with them. They're totally psychotic on the subject of got to create, got to produce. These are two violently opposed philosophies, communism and socialism. The only reason I bring this up is because you sooner or later are going to run into the backwash of all this, and you'll find an environment which is going mad as far as the individual is concerned, but what will look crazy is the individual. Communism allows no family. Children are the property of the state and raised by the state and all that sort of thing, you see. So you have a mother who has a child and starts to provide for the child and works it all out, you see, and is very concentrated on this and all of a sudden goes stark staring mad. And you say, what on earth is this? Why should she go mad? All she was doing is trying to take care of the child. And it is true that, she still has the child with her. What is wrong with this girl? What's wrong with her is now all the now I'm supposed to's have been violated. See? She has a child, and I'm supposed to raise it, and I'm supposed to bring it up to be a credit to the family, and you know, these, and there is no family, and the state is the one that's supposed to bring it up, you see, and everything in the environment is telling her she mustn't do all these things. She's supposed to turn the kid over to the state and skip it, you see. And she goes, grink. Well, now a change is being demanded of her in all of her stable data without the benefit of processing. And she goes mad. So as you get these violent social shifts, you get a consequent flip. You get a much higher incidence of neurosis and psychosis in times of great social change. Because the whole environment is seeking to force the individual to change all of his stable data. In the absence of processing, there is no way for him to do so. So while he is remaining fixed on the stable data, which he has regarding any given subject, the environment has changed. And the stable data no longer fits with the environment. Now, people are prone to tell us that we do this in Scientology. No. No. We give you a changing environment as far as processing is concerned, but everything we've had to do with is still there. Everything I've ever told you is still true. We're just trying to undercut what we know about people. We're trying to get these cases that don't change. Now, what's happened to people is not that they have gone stark staring mad, just because they are incipiently crazy, but this is relatively true. Living up through the trillennia, they have acquired many stable data which no longer have any bearing on their environment. Being fixed upon these stable data, they cannot inhabit the environment in which they exist. What they need is the ability to shift off of their stable data and create new stable data, which has to do with the environment in which they exist. Now, because they are to some degree coping already with the environment, and because they have present lifetime stable data that they have developed to more or less fit the environment in which they live, because of this, it's at first inexplicable why they should be queasy in the wits, why they should feel uncomfortable, why they should feel anxious about these things. Well, that's because all of the stable data of former lives have been invalidated by the existing environment. And they're only sane in one lifetime and stark staring mad in every other one. And that's the backlash you get. And why, when you talk about past lives, it's painful to a lot of people. You're asking them to shift on stable data on which they're already fixated, or you're asking them to try to look at the stable data on which they are already fixated that has to do with, well, the best thing in the world to do is to go out and cut palm branches and put them back and forth across the street on the 13th of April or something. That's the I'm supposed to. And as a matter of fact, if you don't on the 13th of April, you, of course, will probably be hunted up by the inquisitors or the king's guard. You're supposed to be out there with the rest of the population putting these palm branches out on the street because there's going to be a parade. Guy's been jailed for it a few times for not being out there. The 13th of April comes along and he knows he's supposed to do something, but he doesn't know what it is. He just got a feeling that he ought to be doing something. But of course he'll never get a clue as to what it is, because that regime, that religion, that's long, long, long dead and disappeared. And the only restimulator left is the 13th of April. But it's a time restimulator. And all now I'm supposed to is click off on time. Evening, now I'm supposed to eat supper. You see? It's always time, now I'm supposed to. See? Time, now I'm supposed to. Time, now I'm supposed to. The whole society is rigged in this particular direction. Time, now I'm supposed to. If you get uneasy about having appointments set up for you, don't think you're unnatural. I don't think there's anybody on earth that isn't. Guys can get sort of used to it, having long chains of appointments staring them in the face way out into the future. Their life just totally mapped out against time. Well, the guy will go through it like an automaton. But he'll feel like one, too. Because after the time comes the I'm supposed to. Now, you ask people to look at their past lives, and they get a now I'm supposed to, or whatever it is, and it's not right, and that's different, and I've got to get rid of that totally. Well, of course, the fixation, I've got to get rid of that totally, is the counter-effort. It is the counter-create. These people are counter-creating against their past just like mad. See, it was all create, 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 immediately followed by a counter-create, 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 you see. And you'll get fellows who are stuck in present time. They are counter-creating so hard against the past, trying to not is or squidge out of existence all of these past now I'm supposed to's, that almost 100% of their attention is given to that activity and is not in the least given to the environment. I've been talking to you a lot about this idea of attention units, getting people's attention units fixed here, there, and so on, as though I'm just using this to demonstrate that there is no finite quantity of attention units, but I just give you a demonstrate the fellow's got most of his attention on the past, counter-creating out of existence now I'm supposed to's, which no longer fit in the present. He, of course, isn't much here. But another phenomenon will manifest that you will find very interesting, and that is he's stuck in present time. It's sort of like he has a long beam on the ground, you know, and he's holding himself up 6 feet above the ground, and he thinks he'll absolutely perish if he moves down to 5 feet 9 inches from the ground. He must stay at 6 feet from the ground. And it's all counter-create 100% against the ground, you see. And you'll find this fellow floating in PT. He never goes out of present time. Never. And I assure you, that being a mockery of clear, it's a rare case, but it is the wildest case that you'll ever have anything to do with, because you try to run a process on this fellow, and he'll run it on the room, and he never runs anything on the bank. And you ask him to look at the bank in any way whatsoever, you just flip. He's just on the room. You ask him to go back to the time when he's 5 years old and he looks at you like you're nuts. He knows he can't do that. Nobody can do that. You get what I'm talking about now? He's
sort of pinned right up against the ceiling of present time, and he couldn't be anyplace else. But that betokens that most of his attention is then involved on not ising and putting out of existence his past. Now, one of the ways of handling this fellow is to start shifting him out of present time 5 minutes at a time. You know, you came into the session, what did you do? We get him back to the point where he's willing to remember what he ate for breakfast. This is a triumph. But there he is, and his symptom is that there is no bank, and so forth, and there he is. The bank is quite often invisible to this person. He never gets pictures, and so forth. It isn't a black bank. It's very often the invisible bank. Or he may get some kind of a pictures on a V and a dub in. You'll find his whole track is just dubbed. It has nothing to do with the fact. He's stuck in present time, in other words. Now, his sanity, by his own estimation, totally depends upon him keeping not-ised everything that has ever happened to him. And his attention is totally devoted to that and to nothing else. You ask him for a stability in his past. Oh, no, sir. Doesn't exist. Nothing exists. You see, that's the lower scale mockery of now. An individual in good shape can be in present time. Well, this individual on a lower mockery has got to be in present time. When he slips, he goes mad. That's his next step out. He'll just go daffy. Now, his one stability is, as long as the past and all of these contrary stable data of the past remain not is, he will be all right. That's his stability. And you ask him to is some of them. And he knows right away he won't be all right. Remember something? Oh, no. See, he's stuck in PT. It's quite an amazing phenomenon, quite rare, but maybe you have run into somebody like this. Now, this all has to do with time. What's wrong with him, however, is really not that he has fixed data on which he is fixed and change, which is maybe even with a not is, change the fixed data. It really isn't what's wrong with him. It's a loss of ability to fix and unfix his attention at will. And that is a very, very broad, true, basic statement of all aberration and mental difficulty. It's the loss of the ability to fix or unfix the attention at will. Now, we all have some little subjective reality on this. We'll find ourselves driving down the street thinking about the argument we just had or something like this, and we'll keep thinking about it, and we'll say, "Bleh! Devil with that. It's a nice day. Going to be calm about it. I'm going to put my attention here on the road, and I'm just going to enjoy the day." Why do I keep thinking about her or him? Why? What you're protesting against is just the inability to unfix your attention on a moment in time and put it on another moment in time. You're protesting your loss of ability in this particular given situation to shift your attention. That's all you're protesting against. But you've always had these lags. The reverse one, of course, is trying to remember what happened. Why can't I get my attention on this? See, why can't I fix my attention on that moment in time? I just don't seem to be able to. It doesn't seem to be there. And if anything, that's probably commoner than the other one. The ability to fix or unfix the attention at will. Which all adds up to what? adds up to something terribly, terribly, terribly elementary. It's the loss of ability to change attention. Change, of course, being next door to time, is an indirect method of directly processing time. It's the loss of ability to change attention. Now, how do you suppose anybody ever lost that ability? How do you suppose that ever happened? It's overts against change, or using change as an overt. That's all. Now, the individual who dies is only protesting change. The more rapid the change, the more stupefying the consequences. The whole subject of shock is involved in change of attention. There's a rifle, a 220 Swift, which, striking a grizzly bear in the paw — Mr. Grizzly Bear is renowned for his inability to be bothered by little things like rifle bullets. The early expeditions running into Mr. Grizzly and the great American West would put as many as 7 bullets in his brain without killing him. You know, low-speed rifles, low muzzle velocity. Or shoot him 4 or 5 times in the heart and still have him come over and knock somebody's head off, you see? But this 220 Swift hitting him in the paw will kill him. Well, why? It's only a little tiny slug like a 22. But it's traveling at 4,400 feet per second. As opposed to, what you call a 303 is about, with bowtail ammunition, is about 2,780 feet per second. So it's the velocity, the amount of change in space of that bullet, which brings about a condition which will cause Mr. Bear to protest enough to exit. He does a bunk. But lower velocity ammunition does not cause him to do a bunk. He just comes on over and knocks your head off. Looking like a colander. Velocity of change is what kills him. The shift and velocity of change of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima was sufficient to cause time not to exist for 20 minutes to anybody who was in it. And they just didn't drag themselves out of that one. Now, it wasn't the amount of destruction. Probably there'd been that much destruction earlier, but not in that unit of time. It was a tremendous destruction in a very short unit of time, just a split second, bang. And that caused everybody to alter their time considerations. To this day, you could ask one of these victims how long it was, or get him to run through the incident, or something like this, and you find out all of his time considerations were shifted with regard to the incident. They didn't start picking themselves up out of the rubble for actually hours. Fellow just knocked flat in the street, you know, not even really hurt, but just hours later, why, he'd pick himself out of it. He wasn't even knocked unconscious. It was just the ferocity of change, which is to say the velocity of shift. One moment there is no bomb, and the next moment there is a total hurricane of flame, fire, wind, and so forth, of such violence that it actually, for those people, eradicated time. Now, there's Mr. Atom Bomb at work. God bless Einstein. Great man. Great man. He's probably poking around some kindergarten now, come to think about it. Boy, I bet you he doesn't know anything about arithmetic. I bet he's the dumbest student. Now, amount of change per unit of time is, of course, the same thing I was talking to you about when I was saying, want to be there, not want to be there. Now, if you say want to be there, not want to be there, somebody showed me, put those postulates into your finger. You can get a finger pain. Finger wants to be there, doesn't want to be there. And you can make the finger throb. Want to be there, not want to be there. Want to be there, not want to be there. Well, all you got to do is get a not want to be there of sufficient ferocity, you see, to alter the tremendous considerations of want to be there. And these two things will hang up. Bang, you see. And the I don't want to be there, out he goes. But this altered his total consideration of wanting to be there. His total consideration was, I want to be there. And his next overwhelming consideration is not wanting to be there. Now, the amount of time between these two postulates is important. You say, I want to be there. I don't want to be there. That's nothing. Well, so what? Now you say, want to be, don't want to be there. Between those two, there'd be a pain ridge. It's quite remarkable. It's the shift of consideration. It's the velocity of change that brings about what we know as pain and so forth. The total protest against all this is unconsciousness. A fellow has ways of mastering change. Unconsciousness is one of them. I'll not want to be here, and I'll not want to be here. And the best way to handle that is just go out like a light. So you find unconsciousness is a very common response to a considerable change. You walked up somebody and you say, your father's dead. And they go, bang, out. Well, they don't do a bunk. They solve the whole problem by not doing either one. Unconsciousness is the art of being here without being here. So thetans have various remedies for these things. But that is the solution to the problem of change, unconsciousness is. And now we're getting down to some very fundamentals of old Dianetics, because unconsciousness, of course, was one of the keynotes found in an engram. It was the common denominator of all engrams, unconsciousness. Now, if an individual experiences then too much shift of attention in too little time, he experiences various difficulties we call pain, insanity, and so on. This is all sequitur to what I've been telling you here in this unit. You recall some earlier lectures on the subject of pain, insanity, and so on. Now, when that happens in too little unit of time, you get death. The sole cause of death is not a deterioration of the body. A man doesn't die because his heart stops. He can start his heart again. Who's he kidding? You go down to the hospital, you'll find some of the most confoundedly mixed up, mangled cases that are still alive. So if it was amount of destruction of the body which caused death, that would be
a great answer. But it doesn't happen to be, unless you incinerate a body on somebody almost totally. And then he might not even die. He might be still hanging around saying, well, I'm still here. No, it's what causes an individual to abandon or to get out or to leave or to skip the whole thing and so on. And that is an intolerance of change. His intolerance of change is so great that he feels he had better not be there. Now, by his option, he did not pull his attention off his old now I'm supposed to's, his old stable data. By his option, he didn't do that. Because of the overts he has pulled on doing the same things to others, he, of course, yanks his total attention for a moment off of all the now I'm supposed to's with a crash. And it goes into a total confusion. He doesn't know what he's supposed to do. He gets very confused. His next action is to say, this is too confusing around here. The I'm supposed to be here and I'm not supposed to be here and so forth. This is too much. The amount of change of attention here, or change of location, or change of the location of attention, is such that I just better pull out. Now, to keep himself from getting confused in the future about this, he says, that didn't exist. Crush. And he not is it. And there goes death and the disappearance of one's past existence. Death is inevitably and invariably a reaction to change. One soldier on a battlefield gets hit in the finger and he's dead. Another one without a mark on him is found on the battlefield dead. And another fellow, practically sawed to pieces, is carted off to the field hospital and is still alive. What's this all about? Well, what you're studying there is reaction to that particular change. Not just even a general subject of reaction to change, it's reaction to that particular change. Too much change on the battlefield. It wasn't too much change for the last fellow I mentioned. Of course, in Scientology, the woof and warp of death and what it's all about is pretty well known. But just exactly why a person dies, as well, I've mentioned this before in other lectures. It's not exactly all new by a long ways. But why a person dies can be stated to be a protest or intolerance of a degree of change. Now, that could be change of form. It could be change of location. You could take somebody, when they get into the, trying to use humanoids, by the way, in space opera, is one of the more stupid things in the early stages of space opera. They always try it. You've got all sorts of lethal things that the body is not accustomed to. You've got various rays and so forth, but mainly it's mass and heaviness. And an individual departs from the surface of the planet, you see, and he goes up to a tremendous height, which gives him no heaviness of earth. And this change of heaviness, they will find, may be perfectly all right on chimpanzees, but every so often, they'll find one that kicks the bucket. Even a chimpanzee. And then they will madly go in and look and find out what was different about that flight. And they won't find anything different about the flight, and they'll almost go mad. The only thing that was different was that particular chimp's reaction to that particular change. See, that change of mass, heaviness, and gravity was such as to cause him to react. And he reacted by dropping the mock-up. He says, that's too much change for me. I'm going to go up and sit on Venus for a while. Now, they will find this far more pronounced in humans. The first thing they should test in space opera is a person's reaction to change. And if his reaction to change was terrific, why, he might make an astronaut even in a humanoid body. But if his reaction to change is poor, he'll drop the mock-up. The changes of mass, taking something away from somebody. See, a change of mass. Well, you can take something away from one fellow and he doesn't protest. Take the same object away from another fellow and he gets screamingly angry. And reductio ad absurdum, take it away from a third man and he kicks the bucket. These are all different reactions to this thing called change. Now, it's the speed with which we take it away that is part of the reaction. Now, we could vary the reaction by varying the speed of depriving somebody of something. We deprived him of something very rapidly, or if we gave him something very rapidly, this would produce a different reaction on his part to giving him something very slowly or taking something away from him very slowly. You can get a horse to accept a rider, even a wild bronc, if you get him to accept it on a gradient scale. Now we're right into what gradient scales are and why. It is simply minimization of intolerance to change. And that's what a gradient scale is and why it is and why it works. But of course, scales have to be more gradient on some people than on others. Now, I've told you about attention units being trapped in the bank and so forth, this sort of thing. So obviously there'd be a process, and this process would be something on the order of, what has your attention been concentrated upon? Thank you. What has your attention been concentrated upon? Thank you. What has your attention been concentrated upon? Thank you. Now that, oddly enough, all by itself, is not a bad process. It's not a perfect process. But it is not terribly therapeutic or otherwise, but it's a process. It's quite valid. It could probably be run on and on and on and on and on. Now, of course, when you find the individual's attention has been fixated on a certain terminal and then releases attention upon that terminal, you, of course, are getting to the heart of the matter and doing it rapidly. Now, what I've just given you would do the same thing very, very slowly. Or maybe 1,000 to 1. Take you 1,000 times as long to get him straightened out, you see, as if you find out what his attention is really on and gradient his attention off of it. Therefore, your processing is a basis and a means of shifting attention. But there is a process which is not, it's not as good as what you're doing, but it is quite interesting. And that is, would be something on the order of tell me a shift of attention. Or when has your attention been shifted? Or when have you shifted your attention? Or tell me about attention shift. See, you're asking for a change of attention. And any way you ask for when did your attention change, or anything of this character, you're going to get little tiny ridges and that sort of thing snapping out and odd things happening. Because he's fixed on the change between two stable data, not on the stable datum. He's now gotten to the point where he's fixed on change, and that's true of all of your PCs. So when they are protesting change, they do not get well fast. They do not recover fast under processing. Hence, this opens the door to a part of control, which is part of your pre-havingness scale, on some cases that are doing poorly. And it would be just something about a change of attention, just asking for time his attention changed, or something of this character. Asking for the changes, and you'll have some interesting results. And if you run into a case that is totally stuck in present time, I don't know anything else you could do but to ask him for changes.
any way you wanted to ask for it, phrase it in some way, so that you picked up the times when his attention was violently shifted. And you'll get his tolerance to change up, and therefore his case will change and go forward. Thank you.